Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 157. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around we're doing action, adventure and film noir. We're going to start out with a movie directed by Jacques Tourneur in 1951, and that is The Flame in the Arrow, starring none other than Burt Lancaster, Virginia Mayo, and Burt Lancaster's longtime acrobat companion Nick Cravat. So that's a lot of fun to play with. It's a Robin Hoodie kind of thing with a lot of cool and groovy bits and pieces in it. And then we go to a film noir from 1950 directed by Joseph Losey, and it is The Prowler, starring Van Heflin and Evelyn Keyes. A nice little kind of not too well known film noir. And I think you'll like it if you watch it. It's just well done, nicely put together, and aptly dark for a film noir. So sit back, relax. I'm going to get the contact details out of the way, and then we start the show. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. Hello, how's everybody going? Let's see, it's autumn here, but it's sunny outside, the weather's nice, the movie watching, of course, is excellent, and Australia still has a dickhead for a Prime Minister, but you can't have everything. Okay, I'll get straight into the stuff I've been watching, because there are a couple of interesting things on the letterboxed list that I've seen since last I talked at this microphone. Let's see. I watched The Seventh Victim, which was one of Val Lewton's movies that he did, I believe, with Mark Robson for Arco back in the 1940s, starring Tom Conway and Gene Brooks. That's a very spooky one. If you haven't seen that one, the main female character, the missing sister, not the younger sister played by Kim Hunter, has a very goth look. I mean, she's got to be your prototype for that, you know, heavy black hair, bangs across the front, goth look. And apart from that, it's quite an interesting and creepy story, so I kind of enjoyed that a lot. I did see a movie from about 2009, a small budget film starring Zach Galifianakis called Visioneers, which is kind of a weird story told about a very unusual corporation and the people who work in it. And the world's stressed out and people are just randomly exploding, not just the good old spontaneous human combustion, but they're actually exploding like bombs. And it's set in that world, and yeah, it's a kind of low budget minor movie, and a little bit interesting, a little bit different for Zach Galifianakis. And it shows the people who made it were actually thinking through their premise, and yeah, I did kind of enjoy it. I did rewatch a movie that I've talked about on Martian Drive-In not too long ago, which was Spike Jonze's 2013 movie Her with Joaquin Phoenix and the voice of Scarlett Johansson. I did that because Liz and I did it on ABC local radio Northern Territory a while back. And, yeah, we both enjoyed it. It's really cool. Has a lot to say about Siri, of course. And so we did that one. Let's see, what else have I watched? A Japanese movie from the mid-1960s called Latitude Zero, which stars Joseph Cotten, Cesar Romero, and Richard Jekyll's in it as well. It's kind of like a city under the sea futuristic kind of joint. It's got some nice special effects for the time. And apparently it's based on a series of either books or comics or something along those lines that were very popular in Japan. It's a little bit Captain Nemo-ish, but it's kind of aimed at children in the style of 1960s movies that are aimed at children. So apart from the special effects, it doesn't have too much going for it, but it's a little bit of fun, and I just kind of sat through that. I did watch a Hitchcock film as well, one from the mid-1930s called Secret Agent, which starred Madeline Carroll, Peter Lorre, John Gielgud, and Robert Young. Nice movie. I should do it for the podcast at some stage if I haven't already, and after 157 of these and 56 Martian Drive-Ins, it's a little hard at times to remember what I've done and what I haven't done. But Secret Agent is kind of cool. It has some very nice Hitchcockian tropes in it. It has a good rapport between Madeline Carroll and John Gielgud, even though John Gielgud's orientation wasn't heterosexual. They do have a nice little chemistry between them, and Peter Lorre as the general is very good as well. And then I decided to go with some Ernst Lubitsch, just to keep things varied a little bit. I'd done, of course, Ninotchka in the last Martian, Paleo Cinema. And so I decided to look at a couple of musicals that Lubitsch did. And the musicals I went for were Marie Chevalier in The Smiling Lieutenant, which is kind of, you know, one of those silly kind of operetta kind of things. And that was kind of fun. Marie Chevalier was fun in it, though apparently he had a rough time during the making of the film because his mother had just died, and he was very unhappy with the way he acted during the film. And Marie Chevalier in 1930s and 1920s movies is kind of an acquired taste anyway. He's very mannered and kind of, you know, not very nuanced as an actor. He's got the French accent, which he exaggerated a little bit because his English was a little bit better than that, and he mugged a lot. And that came across. And then there's The Merry Widow. I watched that as well, a Lubitsch one from a few years later, which starred him and Jeanette MacDonald. Apparently they didn't get on very well during the making of the film. He called her a prude. She told him he was pinching asses all the time. And so, of course, that one's based on the operetta by Franz Lehár, which I kind of like, even though some of the lyrics for the English language adaptation of it were rewritten by Larry Hart. It says Rodgers and Hart in the credits, but it's actually Larry Hart that did the writing of it. But it does have some lovely Lubitsch touches, including the waltz scene, which has got to be seen to be believed. It's really kind of spectacular. And so I did enjoy watching that. And then I watched a stupid little spy thing from about 10 years ago called Debs, which doesn't have any real stars in it apart from Holland Taylor and Michael Clark Duncan. It's about a girls' school which basically trains secret agents, and the only interesting twist in it is that one of the female secret agent girls, and they're all like 20-odd, falls in love with one of the main villains who happens to also be a woman. So that kind of made it a nice little twist. Nothing spectacular, nothing wonderful, but I watched it because somebody had recommended it on Facebook, and sometimes it can be a wonderful thing, sometimes it can be a not-so-much wonderful thing. But on to the movies I've got for this time around. First one I'm going to do is The Flame in the Arrow, starring Burt Lancaster, Nick Cravatt, and also Virginia Mayo, which is a little bit of fun. It's kind of like an Italian Robin Hood thing, but it's got a few bits and pieces of interest in it. And then we're going to go on to a slightly more serious movie, Joseph Losey's 1951 film noir, The Prowler, starring Van Heflin and Evelyn Keyes. And that's a movie that you should see. So I'm going to take a break. When I get back, I'm going to talk about the first of the two and the lighter of the two, which is 1950's The Flame in the Arrow with Burt Lancaster.
Drinking beer in a cabaret, and was I having fun? Until one night she caught me right, and now I'm on the run. Lay that pistol down, babe, lay that pistol down. Pistol packing mama, lay that pistol down. She kicked out my windshield, she hit me over the head. She cussed and cried and said I'd lied and wished that I was dead. Lay that pistol down, babe, lay that pistol down. Pistol packing mama, lay that pistol down. Drinking beer in a cabaret and dancing with a blonde. Until one night she shot out the light, bang, that blonde was gone. Lay that pistol down, babe, lay that pistol down. Pistol packing mama, lay that pistol down. I'll see you every night, babe, I'll woo you every day. I'll be your regular daddy if you put that gun away.
Lay that pistol down, babe, lay that pistol down. Pistol packing mama, lay that pistol down. Cabaret, and was I having fun, until one night she caught me right, and now I'm on the run. Lay that pistol down, babe, lay that pistol down. Pistol packing mama, lay that pistol down. Now there was old Al Dexter, he always had his fun, but with some lead she shot him dead, his hawking days are done. Lay that pistol down, babe, lay that pistol down. Pistol packing mama, lay that pistol down.
That was Al Dexter with Pistol Packin' Mama. On to The Flame of the Arrow, a 1950 movie directed by Jacques Tourneur after he left RKO Studios, after Val Lewton's production unit there had closed down. And he was kind of freelancing around the place and working for other studios. And underappreciated too. People didn't really appreciate, well, most of the audiences and things didn't really appreciate the Lewton-Tourneur thing. And now Jacques Tourneur's name now, and Val Lewton's name, sorry, are incredibly famous now, and their output is really well appreciated, and we love their movies. But at the time, they were just jobbing directors. There wasn't anything like the media necessary to carry along the legends of their work the way that there is now. 21st century is a good thing in a lot of ways. But this one was actually the first swashbuckling movie that Burt Lancaster ever did. And I was just looking through his IMDb. He started out in The Killers, of course, and I've talked about that on the podcast before. I'm just going to go through a few of the movies that he did just to show you the kind of really cool films that this guy made before. And that's just only in the four-year period before he made The Flame in the Arrow. He did Brute Force, he did Desert Fury, Variety Girl, not so much, that's he was playing himself in that. I Walk Alone, All My Sons, Sorry Wrong Number, which is very, very good. Kiss the Blood Off My Hands, Crisscross, Rope of Sand. So in 4 years he made all of those films, some of which are classic films noir. And then he came up with The Flame in the Arrow. And the reason is, in the 1930s, along with his little mate with the Brooklyn accent, Nick Cravat, Burt Lancaster made his living as an acrobat. In fact, he and Nick Cravat, in between 1935 and 1938, worked as a double act called Lang and Cravat for the Federal Theatre Project Circus. The Federal Theatre Project was a New Deal program that Roosevelt's government did to encourage live arts and to keep people working during the Depression. And Lang Cravat were part of that. In fact, if you go to Nick Cravat's Wikipedia page, you can see a picture of a very young Burt Lancaster and a very young Nick Cravat together behind off stage as a part of that. So he had a long career, it would have at least 10 years, as an acrobat. And this shows in this movie, they take full use of it. And it was one of the first films that was produced by Lancaster's own production company. And he wanted to do this movie. He wanted to work again with Nick Cravat. He wanted to do a bit of swashbuckling, a touch of the Aeroflins. And indeed, this is what he did. And again, it was a smart move to get Tourneur to do it. Even though the movie is in Technicolor, Tourneur does show a few of his trademarks, which I found quite interesting, including one of the duels ends in a very interesting but very Jacques Tourneur kind of way, which makes it a lot of fun. But I'm going to play the trailer for the movie now, and then I'm going to talk about why I think this movie is worth your time.
And and the Arrow. Epic adventure, hurled from the screen with all the pomp and pageantry of history's most colorful era, when a proud people lay crushed in the iron fist of the cruel invader, Ulrich the Hawk of Hesse. Here feudal barons ravaged the land to live in regal splendor upon the rich spoils of victory, until one man rose to challenge the despot, Dardo the Arrow, whose shafts of vengeance struck swift and sure as he led his gallant band on 1,000 midnight raids. Dardo, whose courage in conflict braved the strongholds of the intruder, whose audacity in love aspired to an even more formidable fortress, the heart of the arrogant Anne of Hesse, whose uncle the Hawk had sworn to destroy the Arrow.
Ulrich, if anyone moves, I'll put this apple in your mouth for the fancy-dressed pig that you are.
This is quite foolish, Dardo. None of you will leave the castle alive.
It's Burt Lancaster in the most different portrayal of his exciting career as Dardo. Virginia Mayo as Anne, whose proud spirit defied any man to tame her.
Get out.
Why didn't I think of this before?
What exactly are you thinking?
It seems a shame that such a pleasant conversation should end like this.
What are you going to do?
I'm afraid I have to kill you. Now you better come with me, Dardo.
You want me to make love to you because you're afraid he won't come back.
Dardo.
If anyone interferes, the boy will pay for it.
Sorry about the sound quality on that, but you get a little bit of the Max Steiner music in there as well, so I kept it in there. This movie is a lot of fun to watch. It's one of those ones where if you saw it as a kid, you'd love it. But even if you didn't, it's it's still got a lot of things going for it, and you can kind of see into it a little deeper than you would otherwise. In the movie, Burt Lancaster plays Dardo Bertoli, an archer who's 5 years before his wife has left him, for the evil Count Ulrich, played by Frank Allenby. He's known as the Hawk. Dardo's unfaithful wife is Francesca, played by an actress called Lynn Baggett, who had an unfortunate life. There's some very unfortunate things that happened during her life, and she died early of suicide. But leaving that aside, what Dardo comes into town, Count Ulrich comes into town. Dardo shows his son, his ex-wife, and then shoots a hawk down, which Count Ulrich has just launched after some pigeons that are annoying him. Now, right at the start, the movie kind of has a bit of a problem from a 21st century viewpoint, and that is right at the start, Dardo sounds a lot like one of those guys who wants to get back at his ex, like in a custody battle or some kind of family problem there. And he plays it a little bit like that. He's a very promiscuous guy. He kisses all the pretty girls in town and things like that, but he's still bitter and twisted about the fact that his wife left him for this nasty invader who has taken over their country. But, yeah, you can see it from several viewpoints there. But it doesn't play well from a 21st century viewpoint. But having said that, he shoots the hawk, hunting hawk down, and gets chased by the bad guys, and the bad guys then give his son a little kid whose name is Rudy, played by Gordon Gibert, who is now a professor of architecture in New York University. But leaving that aside, they kidnap the kid and take him to live with his mother in the palace with Count Ulrich. This, of course, pisses Dardo off, but he's got an arrow sticking out of his back, so he's recovering and recuperating in an old Roman ruin up in the hills. So until he feels better, he can't go back and get his son. Meanwhile, at the palace of Count Ulrich, there's a young Marchese, Alessandro de Alessandro de Granasi, played by Robert Douglas, another interesting actor, who wants to marry the niece of Count Ulrich, Lady Anne, played by Virginia Mayo. She is the Maid Marian character of the piece, and Virginia Mayo does have a lot of fun with this one too. She gets to get involved with a little bit of the comedy and things like that, but she's basically the love interest that's there for Dardo to find and woo and win and all that kind of thing. So that's basically it. It's like the Adventures of Robin Hood, only set in Italy with Burt Lancaster in it and different villains. Now, having said that, Robert Douglas is a nice villain there because he gets kidnapped by the merry men that Dardo has up in the mountains, and kind of goes along with them, and he's quite friendly to them. He has a wrestling match with Dardo, and it comes out a draw, and they still haven't played the third round of the wrestling match to make it 2 out of 3. And he lives there and talks to them, and he's quite affable and quite friendly to them in a lot of ways, but ultimately he's just after himself. Now, this movie was written by Waldo Salt, and the reason I'm saying that is it's quite important to part of the plot. Waldo Salt was one of those guys who unfortunately was hit by the was basically blacklisted because of the House Un-American Activities Committee. He was a little bit of a bolshy right-wing kind of guy and got in a lot of trouble for it. But dig this. These are some of the movies that Waldo Salt went on to write the screenplays for. And this is a diversion. I fully appreciate that. But bear with me. Little films like he did a screenplay for Midnight Cowboy, for instance, and The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight, and Serpico, and Day of the Locust, and Coming Home. So he did all of those things in the 1970s. So the same guy who wrote this fluffy little swashbuckling epic in 1950 went on to write the script for Serpico in the mid-1970s and was very well regarded at the end of his career as a screenwriter. So there you go. And also Burt Lancaster was quite a lefty himself and hired him for that reason. Now, the reason I'm mentioning that left-wing bias that Waldo Salt and Burt Lancaster have is there's a bit in the palace between the Marchese, Robert Douglas's character, and Count Ulrich, where the Marchese refuses to pay his taxes. He's one of the richest men in the area, and Count Ulrich is, amongst other things, collecting taxes for the emperor up in Germany, and he refuses to pay it, and gives him kind of one of those effete aristocratic reasons why he shouldn't pay his taxes, and gets away with it as well. And this is kind of one of those things where you look at it another level. It's a little bit of the 1% refusing to pay taxes. So it's a very timely little piece of work, which doesn't do anything except explain the fact that he's a very ambiguous and self-serving character. But in another way, it's something that reflects on into the years. And it's something that we're maybe slightly more attuned to than people were at the time because of the way the culture wars and class warfare across the world, really, is going on at the moment. So Robert Douglas, very ambiguous character. Now, Robert Douglas has with him a troubadour, because as you do. And the troubadour, dig this, is played by an actor who's still alive and who's very well regarded and who was in Hitchcock movies, worked with Orson Welles, amongst other things. And that, of course, is Norman Lloyd, who is 101 years old and has a movie coming out this year. Gotta love Norman Lloyd, if only for that. He was the guy in Saboteur who was trying to kill Robert Young at the top of the Statue of Liberty and eventually falls off the Statue of Liberty. That's Norman Lloyd. One of the other things about Norman Lloyd that's really interesting is married to the same woman for 75 years, and that doesn't happen often in Hollywood. I mean, Norman Lloyd had his career, let's see, when his movie career started late in his life. But he was a director, he's a producer, he did a whole bunch of other things, he's an educator about movies. He did his first movie in 1939, he's still working, so that's pretty good. Third movie, he works with bloody Hitchcock in Saboteur. Then he does Spellbound, A Walk in the Sun, did The Flame of the Arrow. He was in the remake of M that Joseph Losey did, which is the link between the two movies I'm going to talk about today. And a bunch of other things as well. So, you know, like a good, honest, solid actor. He was even in bloody Star Trek, for shit's sake. Star Trek The Next Generation. He was in an episode of that in 1993. So, I mean, going from Orson Welles to working in the Star Trek TV series is pretty good going, really. And all strength to Norman Lloyd. I hope he lives another 100 years because he's an interesting actor. And there's a really good quote from him that I like here that I'm just going to read out because I'm being self-indulgent. And let me see, I'm going to find this quote because it's hilariously funny. When I see that, I mourn for my lost hero. No, when I see that, he's looking at one of his old movies. So he says, when I see that, I mourn for my lost hair. It was red. So I like that. So Norman Lloyd's in there playing a troubadour and he's got very kind of flowery verse to spout. But the core of the movie, of course, isn't even just Burt Lancaster and Anda Hess, played by Virginia Mayo. It's Burt Lancaster working with Nick Cravatte. Now, Nick Cravatte had a thick
Brooklyn accent that he could never get rid of. So in a lot of movies, he played a mute because he was, you know, he was good at pantomime. He was a good mime. He was an acrobat. And whenever you needed a short guy to wear a costume and be acrobatic, he was your go-to guy for it. In fact, he was the guy that played the gremlin on the wing in the episode of The Twilight Zone that William Shatner was in, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. That was Nick Cravat sitting on the wing there pulling the guts out of the aeroplane wing, amongst other things. If only for that, he's got to be a legend. But there's a lot of really cool acrobatics in there. For instance, Burt Lancaster's sitting up on a tree branch, and the horse with Lady Anne comes along beneath him, and Piccolo, which is the character played by Nick Cravat, grabs the horse, and then there's a bit of dialogue there. And Burt Lancaster drops backwards off this branch he's sitting on and lands on his feet. It's got to be like a 10 or 12 foot drop. But no, he just does it. And those kind of things are joyous to watch. Watching Nick Cravat and Burt Lancaster doing tons of athletic things. I mean, climbing up and down the sides of castles and swinging across on chandeliers and all of that kind of stuff is just a hell of a lot of fun. And knowing that in most cases in this thing, there were a few stuntman bits, but in most cases in this movie, that it's actually the actor doing it, adds to that fun. It really does give you a thrill, and it shows you a little bit of the Langan Cravat magic that was part of their stage act when they were working for the National Theatre Circus. So, I mean, it's one of those movies where, yes, you like the sword fighting. In fact, there's a very vicious sword fight in the movie between the Marchese and Dardo, which, I mean, Burt Lancaster isn't a very good swordsman, you can tell. Robert Douglas more so, but he's got a kind of enthusiasm and a fury about the way he fights with the sword that's really makes it play well. Of course, a couple of years later, Burt Lancaster and Nick Cravat did The Crimson Pirate, which I talked about in a very early Paleo Cinema podcast. You need to go back like in single digits to find that podcast. But anyway, the lovely thing that they threw in as a little bit of a fillip to Jacques Tourneur's oeuvre and his trademark things is when the sword fight between the Marchese and Dardo inevitably happens, Dardo slashes the cord holding a chandelier of candles up, and it falls down and the room's thrown into darkness. And because Dardo isn't as good a swordsman as the Marchese is, he uses darkness to kind of freak him out. And there's just a little bit in there where Burt Lancaster's voice is coming out of the shadows and the Marchese's there in the moonlight, a shaft of moonlight, and can't see where his enemy is. And it's a really nice little Jacques Tourneur moment, which I wasn't expecting in the film. But it's really appreciated, and it's just a little bit of a reminder about how incredibly well Jacques Tourneur used shadow, particularly in, of course, Cat People, amongst others, and also in The Leopard Man, come to think of it, which I spoke about in the last Martian Driving podcast. But just seeing a little touch of that in this movie was a very welcome thing. It was like an old friend coming to visit. As I said, the movie is essentially a piece of fluff and is very much a slight steal from the swashbuckling Errol Flynn kind of movies. At this stage, Errol Flynn was starting to drink himself to death, so he wasn't available for the movie. But there's the things you can take away from this are Robert Douglas, really nice villain. I like him as a villain. You've got Norman Lloyd in there as well as a part of the comic relief. You've got Nick Cravat, who's very, very funny and incredibly athletic as well. And you've got Burt Lancaster and Virginia Mayo in there. It's just one of those fun swashbuckling movies that you can just watch, enjoy while it's on, and not need to think about too much afterwards. But it's a little bit of fun, and it showed that Jacques Tourneur, even with, I mean, the budget wasn't too bad on this movie. It was about $1.5 million at the time, which was a fairly good middle-range movie budget. And it's all up on the screen. There's actually a couple of really nice matte paintings I noticed in this film as well, which I appreciated a lot, showing the Italian Alps, which it's slightly stylized, in fact, the matte paintings. They don't look photorealistic, but they're there. And I mean, because it is a little bit of a bagatelle kind of movie, having the matte paintings not be photorealistic doesn't really matter. It gives you the idea that they're in the Italian Alps. And that's good enough for me. And it's got a whole bunch of those usual tropes, like cauterizing wounds with hot irons and people being hung and people being threatened by the bad guys and the hero chaining the heroine up on a chain that used to hold his pet bear just so she wouldn't escape. But that is kind of a nice... They play that nicely. I mean, yeah, it could be a bondage kind of thing and it could be a man being a nasty to a woman, but it's not played like that. What it's played as is Virginia Mayo's character uses it as a way to try to trick him and to kind of get away. She knows that she's chained up and she's pissed off about being chained up, but she doesn't just let it happen. There's a lot of interplay between them about her being chained up, which kind of works well and shows that she's not just a little piece of fluff princess. She's got her own mind and her own beliefs and wants to live a life on her own terms. So there's a little bit of that in there too, which is kind of nice. I've seen a lot of movies of this kind where the female lead is a little bit of a blancmange and not the kind of woman that the guy would look at. And the thing with Virginia Mayo's character in this, Lady Anne, is the fact that she's got to be better looking and sexier than all the women of the village that Dardo spends time with. He reminded me a little bit of Maurice Chevalier's character in The Merry Widow and The Smiling Lieutenant. He's got that kind of overt masculinity. He's very popular with the ladies and he doesn't mind the fact that a lot of the other ladies know it. But that's about it for that one. It's a fun little movie. If you're a bit of a Jacques Tourneur completist, you're not going to be disappointed by it. And there's a lovely, whimsical wonderfulness to the acrobatics in this film. Not all of them were just done by Burt Lancaster and Nick Rivett either. There's a troop of tumblers in the movie as well, which is kind of interesting. And you get a little more of that. I don't know whether they were old friends of Burt Lancaster's from the old days, but there's some really nice bits and pieces of circus madness in the movie, which always I like. I don't mind people dressed up as clowns. Sally, I've got to tell you this, Sally is scared of clowns. She said she was scared of one at a toy store opening when she was a teenager. But she's really gets freaked out by clowns. But for me, I don't mind them. I mean, you know, yeah, big deal. The guy, you can't see the guy's face. Big deal. He's only there to get out of a car with 55 other guys and throw pies at each other. It's not like he's, you know, if butchers dressed like clowns did, you'd be more worried. But anyway, I'm going to leave it at that. And I'm going to take another break. I'm going to get back, going to talk about a very nice little film noir, 1951's The Prowler, starring Van Heflin, Evelyn Keyes. And it's a lovely film.
Please go. Please leave me alone. Stop it. What do you think I am?
Van Heflin is a man of passion who takes what he wants, even if he has to use a gun. Evelyn Keyes as a woman in love whose only crime is her weakness for this man of violence.
Let's face it, if having him dead is the only way we can be together, happily together, I'm glad he's dead.
Between you and me, he wasn't the easiest person in the world to live with. And she wanted children and, well, he couldn't have any.
Can't, darling, please.
You do it because you've got to.
Ever listen to the voice of your own conscience? Do you know the crimes you have committed in your heart? See what happened to these two who could not lose the voice of their conscience, the voice that was mine.
Here's the synopsis for The Prowler from Google. After being frightened by a peeping Tom in her mansion in the beautiful Susan Gilvray, Evelyn Keyes, calls the police for help. When a policeman, Webb Garwood, Van Heflin, arrives, he becomes infatuated with Susan and the two engage in an affair. Susan soon ends their relationship, choosing to remain with her husband, John. However, Webb's obsession with her continues to grow until he begins to plot to kill John and cash in on his life insurance policy. See, dead straight up film noir plot. It's just, it could be Double Indemnity or one of those. Guy falls in love with a woman. They kill the husband for the insurance. It seems at the surface of things, dead straight up and down. No ambiguity, no problem there. But this is a Joseph Losey film, and it's a bit different, and it takes things past the normal conclusion that we have for this kind of film. And it does it in some very interesting ways. Now, Van Heflin, really interesting actor. People remember him from things like Shane, and he was the bomber in the first Airport movie as well, but really good character actor. He did a lot of stage work, so he was very great at his craft. He was terrific at his craft. And the character he brings for Webb Garwood is kind of interesting. He's got a chip on his shoulder. He thinks he's had bad breaks. He thinks that other guys have it easy because they're rich. And he's one of those kind of slightly self-pitying but cocky guys that film noir seems to have a lot of. And he doesn't like being a cop. He's a cop because other things didn't work for him. He was a great basketball player, but he couldn't work as part of a team, so his basketball career didn't go ahead. He doesn't really have an ability to be slightly more objective about his life than he is. He's always got a reason why things didn't go his way. And that is the major flaw in the character. Each film noir protagonist has a major flaw in his character. And with Webb, it's the fact that he thinks that other guys have it easy, and he thinks that he's had a lot of bad breaks. So he meets Susan, played by Evelyn Keyes, and she's a failed actress in Hollywood who's married a radio host who does the overnight shifts on the radio and records his radio talks on records so he can improve what he's doing. He's a much older man than she is. She's bored and doesn't have much to do with her life. Her husband, it's implied, is impotent, so they can't have children. And so she's kind of living a comfortable life, but not a life that has much excitement in it. And it's more there's not really a power balance in her relationship with her husband, even though we only ever see him once, and he says maybe two words in the whole movie. He's a very much a looming presence for the rest of the film. So Webb and Susan have their affair. And the interesting thing about this is, and I was watching this now, I'm going to get a bit personal again here, and as you know, I do this in the podcast. Before I met Sal, I have been in that situation that Webb Garwood's in. I have had affairs with married women in my past, and I could kind of empathise with him in a really sick, fucked up kind of way in some ways. The fact that, she's got to live a double life, but you want her kind of thing, and that can make you act stupidly. I'd never actually killed anybody's husband. I'll be up and honest about that. And if you want to run a polygraph test or a vocal stress indicator test or something on me saying that, you'll find that it's true. But there have been times when, I've dallied with married women. You can get very obsessed with a married woman because she's not there all the time. The only bits of her life that you have are the enjoyable in-bed bits, that kind of stuff. So you can get a false idea of who the person you're having the affair with is, the pressures they have in their own life, and you can have a very skewed view of the object of your affection. And that's indeed what Webb has, and plus with his character faults, he doesn't have the ability to realize this isn't the kind of life he wants to live. Yes, he's unhappy in his job. Yes, he's having an affair with a woman he's obsessed with, but it's not right. And he never moved past that stage. He never had that moral compass to say it's not right. So he sets things up so that in the performance of his police duties, he accidentally, in inverted commas, shoots Susan's husband. And pretends that he's been wounded by him. He shoots himself in the arm to pretend that he's been wounded by him. There's a court case, and he's shown to be innocent. He then approaches Susan again, and they get married. And that's where things get really interesting, because it takes it in a direction that I wasn't expecting and that film noir doesn't usually go. Now, I'm not going to tell you what the thing is, except for the fact that Susan gets pregnant. Now, just having that there, one of the things about movies, you got to remember this is 1950, so it's just at the end of the 1940s. We're still 12 to 15 years away from having contraceptive pills and reliable contraceptives of pretty much any sort. Condoms broke. Some people didn't use them. Syphilis and other STIs were rife and all of that kind of stuff. So pregnancy with affairs was definitely a possibility in those days. But they were never something that was spoken of in movies. They were never a consequence of the affairs that happened in Hollywood films of that time. Except in this case, really, and that's, it does lead to the ultimate, I mean, of course, this is during the production code, so of course murderers have to be punished. And the pregnancy is a direct source of that punishment in a very interesting way. That's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to spoil the end of it. I'm not going to tell you what happens. I'm not going to tell you who dies and who doesn't. But the thing I find most interesting about this film is it was actually, the script was written by Dalton Trumbo while he was blacklisted from working in Hollywood. And not only was the script written by him, and he wrote it under a pseudonym, and that pseudonym was Hugo Butler, but the voice of the husband on his radio show, which you hear in the background in a number of scenes, including crucially one scene near the end, is actually Dalton Trumbo's real voice. So this is just before Joseph Losey jumped ship and moved to Europe to avoid the House Un-American Activities Committee and the Hollywood blacklist. He actually fled before they got a hold of him and stayed over into Europe for most of the rest of his career. In fact, all of the rest of his career. But not only, so basically he used not only a blacklisted screenwriter, but he used his voice as one of the voice actors in the film. The only reason that Joseph Losey could get away with this was it was an independent film. It was made by a company called Horizon Pictures. It was distributed by United Artists in the UK, in the US, British Lion in the UK, and United Artists in a whole bunch of different overseas markets, which, but by that time, of course, the movie had been made and they had no input into who you use for various jobs. The people knew that blacklisted writers were writing under pseudonyms, but they kind of kept that on the quiet because they were getting such good writing out of them. And Trumbo's script is very good there. One of the complexities of the movie that makes things really interesting is the fact that there are times when you sympathise with Webb, even though he's the murderer, even though he's manipulating the woman, even though he's a character with few redeeming qualities. He is charming, and you get the idea during the arc of the movie that he genuinely has a feeling that, not unlike love for the character of Susan, and she definitely loves him. So even though he ostensibly has killed her husband accidentally, in inverted commas, she doesn't know that he did it with malice and intent until quite late in the piece. Even though she has her suspicions, he's very good at kind of consoling her and explaining it to her and sounding sincere and honest and manipulating her emotions by that means, which is something that guys, some guys have a talent for doing. But he is a likable character in various moments in the film, and I find that interesting, the fact that they played it that way. Van Heflin's a character actor of enough range that he could have played it either way, but his acting required that balancing, that you've got to see why Susan is attracted to Webb, the character. And that's something that Van Heflin puts across very well. Then you've got Evelyn Keyes as well. I liked her in a lot of films. I think she's one of those actors that didn't really get as much credit as they needed to get. In fact, I talked about her in a not too distant Paleo Cinema podcast as well, when I talked about the 1954 film Hell's Half Acre. She's the protagonist in that, and she plays things very strongly. She was married at the time that the Prowler was made to John Huston. She'd been married to Artie Shaw, the band leader, before that, but she was married to John Huston, and they were right at the end of their marriage at the time this movie was made. In fact, it was set up as a starring role for her, and it didn't quite launch her career the way that she would have wanted, and of course that Huston wanted, and that's unfortunate because she is good in this. I don't think the writing for her character is as strong as the writing is for the Webb character played by Van Heflin, But I think that she puts across the emotional complexity of the character, the fact that she is kind of bored and just living day to day, and she loves her husband at a certain level but doesn't love him at another level. And she's kind of built for herself a gold-plated cage. She's well off, she's well taken care of, she doesn't need to go to work. Her husband's successful and financially secure, but her life just isn't what she wants of it. And the Webb character is seen as a way of having some form of adventure and something to look forward to in her life. And Evelyn Keyes puts that across very, very well in the film. Now, there are a whole bunch of minor characters in there. There's a couple, one of whom is Webb's partner on the police force. And they're played by very kind of low-key. The movie was made on not too big a budget, so the character actors you get for these minor roles are definitely A-grade character actors. So to play his partner, you get an older character actor. So his partner, the kind of veteran cop character, is played by an actor called John Maxwell. And his wife, Grace, is played by an actor called Catherine Warren. And they're very plausible as a couple. They've both got an interest in geology, and they go off into the desert and collect different rock samples for their own education. It's a hobby for them. And it's something that they share together, and he gets a little bit boring on the subject when Webb comes over for dinner one night. But they're kind of realistic character, and they kind of fill in the background. They give a richness to the life of the other characters by having that supporting role and the characters having those little tweaks. And in fact, the fact that they do go off rock fossicking is quite important to the arc of the plot of the movie as well, in a slightly obscure and left field way. One of the other people you see in there is an older actor called Madge Blake, who played Aunt Harriet in the Batman TV series about nearly 20 years after this one, 15 years after this movie. She was Aunt Harriet in the Batman series, and having her pop up is kind of interesting too. But there are some really nice touches that Losey brings to the movie. Right at the start, you see things from the viewpoint of the Peeping Tom at the start of the film, just before the titles come up. You've got Evelyn Keyes in her bathroom just wearing a towel, and the audience becomes the, you know, we've seen things from the point of view of the Peeping Tom, which kind of brings us right into the voyeurism aspect of it as well, which is a kind of an interesting choice there. But there are other things that Losey does as well. It's a really clever use in this film of sound design, because after Susan and Webb get married, they buy a motel in Las Vegas. And there are a few scenes where the tension mounts up, and the motel is, you know, on a fairly busy highway. And the sound design of the cars passing by really does kind of enhance that tension and show that the perfect little motel home, the business that Webb wants to run, isn't quite as perfect as he wanted it to be. The rooms that they live in are very noisy because of the traffic flow, for instance, and it just gives you that little hint without explicitly stating anything that the life that he's set up for them isn't as perfect as it might be. And there's also the sound design of using the husband's voice on the radio as a way of being a counterpoint to the plotting and to the dialogue going on with the two main characters. And that's interesting too. It's clever writing and very good sound design. If there were Oscars for sound design at the time, this one would definitely have to be up for it. And one of the things that they have is that the husband's been playing a song on the radio, and Dalton Trumbo's voice comes on saying, "That was a song called Stolen Fun." And it very much relates to the fact that Webb and Susan are lounging on a couch together. And the husband, whose name, I should give the character a name, is John Gilvray, always ends his broadcast with, "I'll be seeing you, Susan." And that comes back to haunt them as well in a really creepy kind of way when they've run away with each other. And there's a scene towards the start where Webb's out of cigarettes And Susan tells him that her husband has a cassette locked away in his desk and that he keeps it locked for no really good reason. So Webb borrows one of her bobby pins and picks the lock on the desk so he can get a packet of cigarettes out of the desk. And there's that kind of parallel between Webb sleeping with the man's wife and then picking the lock and stealing his property. Because, of course, at the time, the women were, in some level, seen as the property of men. So you got that kind of little thing, which also is also another important plot point, because when he gets the cigarettes out, Webb sees the last will and testament of the husband, and that starts the whole arc of killing the husband into play. But that's really good writing. I like that little bit of Trumbo's writing where one thing leads to another, which is part of the engine of the plot. And there's also a bit of class warfare in this film too. The fact that Webb's from the wrong side of the tracks and grew up in the same town Susan did, and she grew up on the right side of the tracks. There's that class warfare thing, and there's that kind of sense that Webb has of the fact that he is underprivileged and he is from the wrong side of the street, and he isn't in some ways good enough for the woman, which adds to the tension, of course. And we do see where Webb lives compared to where she lives as well. She lives in a nice, comfortable mansion, which they say at the start is worth about $40,000, which is a lot of money in those days. Whereas Webb has a one-room apartment in a fairly shabby building, which is used to the contrast the two characters in a very pointed way, that part of the problem and part of the reason why Webb is as he is because he was born poor and because of that financial inequality that exists in the world. It's not used as an excuse for him. It's used as part of the motivation and part of the bricks and mortar that put that character together. And it shows that poverty does lead to crime in some ways. Though, were he a different kind of character, Webb could be doing okay. Yeah, he's a cop, and yeah, he's earning a certain amount of money, but his perception of the way that the world works is not the same as the way the world actually works. And that makes his character understandable, if not acceptable, to the audience, which is kind of cool. Now, James Ellroy has said at one stage that this is his favourite film, and he helped to pay for a digital restoration of this movie as well, which is great, because I've seen other copies of it which were available online, and the restored version is sharp and crisp. There are some scenes in the desert which are very well done, and the scenes in the house and the scenes at night have all been digitally sharpened up, and the undigitized version of it, the undigitally enhanced version of it, was in pretty bad nick before Ellroy and a bunch of people at some universities in Los Angeles did the digital restoration on this movie. And I'm glad they did, because it's a movie of Losey's that I hadn't seen before today. I watched it earlier today, and I like it. I think it's a good, honest film noir. I'm surprised that I haven't found out about it before. Maybe only because the digital restoration was done recently and there wasn't a good copy of the film available. Now, I'm reading from a small, ratty, old 1960s paperback called The Cinema of Joseph Losey by James Lay. And Losey said some interesting things about this film, one of which was he did more rehearsal on this film than he had with any of his other films before or after, for the simple reason that they didn't have a long shooting schedule, and they wanted to get as much of a down pat in the rehearsal process, because a rehearsal hall is a lot cheaper than studio lights, camera people, makeup people, and all that kind of thing. So they did a lot of rehearsal. He said it was disappointing to him because it's felt, even at the time it was being made, like it was a period piece from the 1930s and the 1940s, and this was 1950. So to Losey, it seemed a little bit dated. And one of the things he said about the Susan character, which I found kind of interesting, is, yes, the interviewer says to him, "I think the girl is a very complex character." And he says, yes, she's also a product of the things that happen so often in America and still happen everywhere I know of in the West. In spite of all the pretensions we have grown up and have to some extent, been realized, the wife is left alone, presumably with everything to see she's comfortable, but with no friends and with no values except those from her childhood, with no love, essentially, and in this case, no children. So basically, she's there for when her husband needs her. And that's part of the reason why she finds Webb so attractive. He's adventurous, he's exciting, he's something to look forward to. And, yeah, I mean, this movie is a good, honest film noir. I really like it. I'm going to watch it again sometime over the next year, I think, because I think it may be worth watching for a second time. And it's one of those film noirs that I like because there are some scenes set in a desert. And, like, for some reason, I like film noirs that are set in a desert. I think it's that kind of aridness and the ostensible lifelessness of the landscape adds something to this genre, that the kind of, you know, rain-swept streets don't quite have. I think that the isolation gives people more room to commit crimes. It gives them the illusion that they're going to get away with it if they commit a crime in a parched desert place way away from anybody else. It's the kind of constraints of society and civilization are just that little bit looser out in those kind of places. And again, it's a kind of quality of the desert that you see in modern films as well. I'm just grabbed a Blu-ray off the shelf for a very good Australian movie, which can be considered in some ways a film noir, Mystery Road from 2013, directed by a guy called Ivan Sen, who's an Indigenous Australian director. Stars Aaron Patterson. And that's the movie that this movie reminded me of, because it's got that feel of isolation, of characters having a past that kind of influences and pushes them in a certain direction. But that's about all I want to say about it. I want to watch this movie again. I really do. I think that these kind of film noirs that didn't really make a fortune at the box office, but are good, honest efforts. And also, and this is another virtue of the film, which I really like, the fact that they kicked the blacklist in the guts. They used Trumbo anyway, and they used his voice. They used his script. The director was about to be probably put in jail by Senator McCarthy and those guys before he nicked off to England. Had a good career in the 1960s and 1970s. This movie shows that even when there is repression and people trying to keep the lid on certain belief systems in art, it always leaks through. It's like trying to stop neutrinos with a tennis racket. You're not really going to do it. They're going to find their way through anyway. You can't stop people having their opinions, and you can't stop them pointing out certain things about society. And that's what film noir does. Underlying everything is that kind of class warfare and the criminalizing qualities that poverty have. You look at any film noir, and there's very rare that rich people commit crimes for money, for instance. There's always a guy from the wrong side of the tracks who meets up with a rich dame and things happen. There's that class aspect to film noir that really didn't occur in a lot of other genres at the time, except maybe in Douglas Sirk films that starred Rock Hudson. But anyway, I'm going to finish up there. So just to finalise, The Prowler is an interesting film, not only because the title character only appears in the first minute of the film, but because the acting is very good, the script is very good, and the direction is superb. And I hope there are more film noirs that I haven't seen yet, like this one, that are out there, and I've just got to find the right time and the place where we cross paths and I'll enjoy them, because I do like it as a genre a lot. I think it's got a certain working class honesty about it, which I appreciate increasingly as time goes on. And I like seeing who's in the background, who the little character actors are in the background, what the cars were like, what the rooms were like, what appliances were in kitchens, all of that kind of period detail that we now get from movies of 50 to 70 years ago. They're time capsules as well as entertainments, and that's a really cool thing. So anyway, that's about it this time around. I don't have any feedback, and again, that's your fault. But please support the Patreon campaign. We do have another person supporting the Patreon campaign, and that is our second unit director, Mark Leeper. I haven't had time to add his name to the credit reel at the end of the podcast, but thank you, Mark. And if people want to support the podcast, patreon.com/paleocinema. Anyway, enjoy your movie watching until the next time I talk at you. If you have any suggestions for the podcast, I'm willing to take them. In fact, our good friend Morris suggested yet another movie for me to add to the list that I'll look at in the future, and that was Billy Liar from the 1960s. He did that while I was podcasting. He sent a Facebook message saying, have you done Billy Liar? And if not, why not? So I do have a list in a nice book, and I'm adding movies to it constantly. So anyway, look after yourselves. Be nice to each other, be nice to yourselves, and watch some good and bad films. Remember, those vulgar pleasures are also important. And I will talk to you again very soon. Again, thanks to all of the lovely people who support the podcast through the Patreon campaign. And as usual, in the manner of movie credits, here are their names and their jobs in the mythical Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In movie. Thank you to Alyssa the Location Scout, Tansy the Foley Artist, Miss Jane the Wardrobe Mistress, Christopher the Gaffer, Chris the Camera Operator, Julia the Casting Director, Elaine, the scientific advisor, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Armin, the key grip, Jan, the dialect coach, Morris, the musical director, Gary, the prop master, Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, and our newest supporter, Claire, the script doctor. So thank you very much to all of those people, and if you'd like to join them on the credits, go to patreon.com/paleocinema. I'd also like to thank Sally, who is the assistant to Mr. Frost and his muse, and also to Mr. Debussy for playing his music, The Gollywog's Cakewalk. I'll see you all again soon.